Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Passports, Please, conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. We are your hosts, Dr. Chick Morgan, the Cowgirl PhD diva, and the multi-international award-winning photographer,
Rodney Burseal.
Rodney Burseal. We want to welcome you to another episode in season one of our inaugural season focusing on Africa. And if you've been listening to our prior broadcast, you know we're focusing on this because it needs focus. It's such a huge topic and came out of conversations that Rodney and I had after his brilliant photographic trip to Africa about 6 months ago. So that's why we're starting, and it's our pleasure to take you along on the journey with us. Today, we have a great guest to add into our mix, Mr. Rick Minshew, who is also, believe it or not, from Wimberley, Texas. This is a pretty awesome town, isn't it, Rodney?
It's getting more and more.
We can't talk about that. No. Maybe soon. Maybe soon, but not today. So we have wonderful artists and writers and musicians, and certainly, as we've been learning, and you all know if you know Rodney, photographers. And we're happy to have him partner in a five-week immersion into Africa. And that's what we're going to hear about from Rick and Rodney. Now, you've been hearing about it from Rodney. So, Rodney, I think we're going to have a little ballast to some of the stories you've been telling. Somebody else who was an eyewitness there to kind of keep you honest and straight.
Yeah.
Big job, as we all know, if you know Rodney.
But don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
A good story. Absolutely. That's our motto on this podcast, isn't it? So, Rodney, why don't you introduce Rick to our listeners?
Oh, where do I start? there was an article that somebody had done on me in a local magazine here in Wimberley. How long ago was that, Rick?
Six years ago?
Wow. And I guess a friend of Rick's read it and called Rick and asked, you know, hey, do you know this guy? Because he's doing a lot of the same things that you're doing. And Rick sent me an email.
Which was described as what, Rodney? The things that you're doing.
Well, just the travels. We've either gone to a lot of the same places or, you know, places that were, you know, we've got this, pretty much had the same bucket list.
Yep.
And, so he emailed me and said, we've got a lot of similarities. You know, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And we got together and we've been best buds since.
Well, I find, first of all, an amazing part of that story is you spent 5 weeks in close quarters in Africa after a cup of coffee. You guys either have a really low bar or you really had an incredible cup of coffee. Let's hope it was the latter.
We had done a couple of Cuba trips together and have gotten together. And by the way, hey guys, I'm tickled to death to be here. My friend sent me this link to this interview that Rodney did in this magazine, and she goes, "Do you know this guy?" She goes, "He's a huge music guy, which I follow the music scene in the Austin area as well." And she goes, "He's a scuba diver and into adventure travel." She goes, "If you don't know him, you're destined to be best buds." And I had read the article, and it had a link to another article that showed some of Rodney's photographs with the killer whales on a dive trip to an area called Socorro, which is about 250 miles straight south of Cabo San Lucas. And I had been on this same trip about a month before Rodney did. So I saw, dang, Rodney was on this trip. And it's like, I've got to hear more about it. So I emailed him and I said, I want to hear more about this. I want to pick your brain. Let's get together for a cup of coffee or a beer. And
it ended up being copious amounts of wine.
I think.
Many good things are done in the presence of copious amounts of wine. Well, when Rodney and I first started talking about the podcast and launching with Africa, and we did say, you know, it is a pretty big place and a pretty big topic. So when we were talking about how great it would be, Rick, to have you on our show to add some additional focus and color, one of the things that we had talked about is, again, with the perennial question, where do you start? And we decided to try to have a conversation with you guys, or you guys would have a conversation, an opening conversation, around the part of your trip that was in Ethiopia. So, Rodney, why don't you take us into Ethiopia with Rick, and let's hear what that was like for you guys.
Yeah, it was, like I said, you know, Rick and I have been, had similar travel interest, and we have been talking about Africa for, God, a long time.
Several years.
And long story short, it finally happened, and it was, I think it was originally going to be a 2-week trip, and it ended up being 5 weeks, because we kept discovering, you know, we want to do this, and Rick's like, well, what about this, what about this, what about this, and he finally, he called me one day, and he said, you need to look into the Omo Valley in Ethiopia, and it was sending me links and photos.
And how do you spell that?
OMO.
Yeah, just OMO.
Okay, because there are probably people sitting in their computers are going to Google half of what you say. And so
The Omo Valley is in the southwestern part of Ethiopia. It borders Kenya to the south and South Sudan to the west.
Yeah, and from the story, you know, we've been talking about Tanzania and Kenya and Ethiopia. It's so rich, and there were so many things going on that it was literally information overload, and I needed to bring Rick in to fill in the things that I'm forgetting, because we're going to have different, I think we remember different things. And he's got this crazy thing of remembering names of places, the most bizarre names. I don't know how he does it. So.
Unusual names.
Right? Yes. Yeah. we can't remember what we had for dinner. But
That's right. Absolutely. I can remember. Yeah, it's
so, but yeah, I guess we can just start on the.
Well, before we do that, just one more little precursor here, because I remember one of the many, many gifts that Rick brought to this enterprise was his in-depth skill for planning.
Yeah, it's.
And how did that contribute to the trip?
I do a lot of research on just about every trip we go on.
I mean, Rick will. Even just having people over for dinner, he will send you this 3-page list of what what you're going to expect and what the evening's going to be. He loves detail and explaining things. And
that's really not your thing, is it, Robin?
No, not at all. And yeah, he ended up really being.
Sounds like the perfect odd couple here.
Yes.
Yeah, I've always been pretty perfect. High detail. And
It got to the point he was sending me link after link after link, and I don't think I read half of it just because I didn't have time to. And I'm like, how do you do this? But he just loved doing it, and he finds the most random things, and it's like, you know, now he's, as soon as all this quarantine's over, I'm sure he's already got about 10 other trips. Plan and
well,
it's,
I yeah, wish that was the case. It's not yet, but
that's the joke. It's like, just give me your credit card and we'll go.
I never knew Ethiopia or the Omo Valley existed until about 3 years ago. My wife and I did a trip to Papua New Guinea and shot the photographed the tribal people there, and then we did a couple of dive resorts, two weeks of diving after that. And we were at a dive resort and met this couple from San Francisco. She was a ER doctor from San Francisco and had worked in Africa as a doctor for several years and has been to Africa 15 times and has done the mountain gorilla trips like 7 times. And I was picking her brain, you know, all week long about Africa because we talked about going for years. And she was telling me that of all the places she's been, Ethiopia was the most amazing cultural experience she ever had. And then kind of discovered Omo Valley, and like I said, I had no idea that existed. I mean, Ethiopia was never been on my radar. Every time you heard of Ethiopia, you think about the late 80s, you know, the Feed the World and all the horrible pictures of the emaciated kids. And
yeah, you never, yeah, it's not a place you think to go for vacation.
Yeah.
And well, let's talk about where you were gone for 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that particular segment come into your trip? And at some point, I want to hear how that may have influenced one way or the other, if you'd gone earlier rather than later. But
right.
Where did it come in?
The Omo Valley, we found out you really have to do it as a 9-day trip. It's a lot of driving, a lot of time in a car.
At least 9 days.
And when my wife and I first started looking at Africa, and I said, I really want to see Ethiopia. What do you think about it? And she goes, you know, I would, after 3 days of the tribal stuff in Papua New Guinea, I was kind of tribaled out. I would rather spend extra time with the animals in Tanzania and Kenya, and then let you and Rodney go on to Ethiopia to photograph the tribes there. So that's how kind of that evolved. And Rodney and I were like, yeah, we get to spend extra time with the animals and do Ethiopia. I mean, that was pretty nice. So the normal tour operators that put together the safari type trips in Africa, don't touch Ethiopia. You've got to go through a specialized Ethiopia tour operator to set up the Elma Valley tours. There's a lot to it. A lot of coordination, when you're going to arrive to the tribes and lots of details there. So we kind of researched that. We talked to about six or seven different tour operators.
Yeah, and Rick really scored in that regard too. Like I said, with all the research that he does, he found this guide that he, as a kid, you know, he grew up in one of these tribes that we went and visited. And what did he speak? Two or three languages, and then right. The ones that he didn't speak, he would find a guide, you know, from that tribe that would take us in, and so we could communicate with these different tribes.
And so what was your initial entry into the country?
We flew in from Kenya, from Nairobi, Kenya, to Addis Ababa, the capital, and our original itinerary had changed because I had heavy rains in the original airport we were supposed to fly into for the Elma Valley. The highway was washed out. So he contacted us about 3 days before we got there and had us fly into an airport called Jemma, which was, I guess, the closest airport to the South Sudan border. And it was about a 10-hour drive from the Jemma airport to the Suri tribe, which is the first tribe we visited. One of our most important tribes we wanted to see because they are the most remote, the least visited, but also considered the most ornate tribe. With the body paint, and a lot of the women have both lip plates and ear plates, and lots of body scarification, which is in many cases was art on their bodies.
Let's I think we need to start from getting us there.
Jemma, and gotcha.
let's start the adventure at the airport because
okay.
Yeah, the 9 days that we were in Ethiopia. The first 2 hours were the most insane experience of my life.
So, Fitsum, our guide from, and he was the owner of the tour company that we used, and he had had this tour company put together for about 6 years, and picked us up at the airport. We had lunch in town, Jemma, and then started off driving through all these villages.
These villages, Well, for starters, the roads there are actually the main road is nice now, but I mean it's paved. But these were the original roads that all the villagers had used to carry, you know, like the coffee beans and transporting their livestock. And I guess at some point, I guess the government came in and paved this road.
They considered it their highway. There, 7 of the 10 hours to the Suri tribe was a 2-lane paved road that considered their highway, but it was riddled with these huge deep potholes everywhere,
and many obstacles.
Well, what kind of vehicle were you in?
Were you equipped
to handle those potholes?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was a four wheel drive truck.
Yeah,
it was a
SUV.
Yeah, it was like probably a Toyota or something, but. I guess you just can't be polite about it. Yeah. But the people, the way they drive, it's insane. We're going 60 miles an hour through what should have been, you know, 10 miles an hour, and you're dodging dogs, chickens, goats, kids, old men.
Cattle, donkeys, camels,
and the hippo, which we'll get to later. Yeah. But I mean,
I'm making a note about the hippo. Yeah. We don't want to forget that.
I mean, chimpanzees. They're just, everything is in the road, and it never stops.
Right.
And you're white knuckled. Rick and I were in the back seat, and we were on the two sides of the truck, and our cook was in between us. And when we say cook, you know, don't think this was something fancy. You know, this is a guy that just, you know, cooking some things up.
Heats up the beans.
Yeah, exactly.
There was five of us.
That's the way I cook, by the way. Just, so there's no misunderstanding.
Well, maybe you could be our cook next time.
I would love to.
Yeah, there was five of us in the SUV. It was a small SUV.
A small one.
We had a driver that was probably in his young 20s, and then Fitzam, our guide, and the owner of the tour company that we booked through, and then Rodney and I were in the back seat with the cook sitting between us, and it was crowded with five people. And
yeah, it was not fun on the back, and yeah, because you're all scrunched up and smashed against the window, and yeah, there was nothing luxury about this.
Sign me up.
Yeah,
and after we left the airport, once we got to the airport in Gemma, I think there was three other tourists we noticed, and we saw them close to the Surrey tribe, but after that, you know, we didn't see another tourist.
Did we see those same people at the airport too?
Yeah, that when we got off the plane. Yeah,
I don't remember that.
And after that, we never saw another tourist the entire 9 days we were in Ethiopia. And you know, as Rodney said, I mean, you know, there's these huge deep potholes in the roads. Then there's hundreds and hundreds of people there's no shoulder on the side of this road, and what tiny little dirt there was what was really muddy. So hundreds of people were walking in the middle of the streets, the middle of the highway, and the cars were constantly honking. All the cars were going 50, 60 miles an hour, constantly honking, and the people were just oblivious to the cars honking. And then you had to dodge, you know, like Rodney said, dogs and these huge herds of cattle and goats. Literally,
you know, for 8 hours of driving, There was never a time that there wasn't something to dodge. It was nonstop. So you
never get used to it. It sounds exhausting.
Yes,
mentally.
It was mentally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you just want to yell, slow the hell down.
And I finally did at one point after we killed something else. But you know, yeah, but it would. How far along were we in the journey before with the incident that we'll go into?
Probably about 2.5, maybe 3 hours. And there was also hundreds.
Was it that long? I felt like we'd been in the car for about 30 minutes when it happened.
And there was hundreds and hundreds of tuk-tuks, the little two man taxis like that Thailand is famous for, which is basically like an egg shaped structure on a motorcycle that'll carry two other people. There was hundreds of those. So all the cars were, it was like a video game. All the cars were constantly weaving in and out of the potholes, the people, the animals, the tuk-tuks. And it was without a doubt white knuckle driving.
But part of your introduction, and Rodney, you just alluded to it oh so briefly. It was on this initial drive from the airport where you had the all capital letters, the incident.
Right.
Is that correct? So you hadn't been in the country but 3-4 hours.
Right.
At most.
And your brain is just going haywire because of all the stimulus that you're experiencing. And then, Rodney, why don't you
tell us what happened when we had left, you know, like I said, Rick was explaining with the weather and the having to fly into a different airport, our travel schedule completely changed. And it was an 8-hour drive from the airport to this first tribe. So an hour, 2 hours into it, we had been, you know, you're going through, you just hit these little, you know, little town after town after town. And it's the same scenario. And I don't know, Rick, well, I guess at that time we were going about 40 miles an hour in this, like I said, an area should have been 10 miles an hour. And we're both just staring out the window, out the side window, because you can't look out the windshield because it's just, there's too much going on. I'm trying to block it all out. And then just all of a sudden, the brakes slam, and I look up, and this old man goes flying through the air.
Mm. He looked like he was probably in about his mid-70s. They live a hard life, and he could have been much younger.
Yeah, he was probably younger than he looked. But, he looked more like 80 to me. But I mean, just very frail. and literally saw this guy flying through the air. And Rick and I just look at each other like, oh my God. We didn't, I instantly was like, we're not getting home. we're going to an Ethiopian prison and you're never going to see us again.
Everything in these villages were very close together. We were driving through and everything in these villages were interesting. So we were, and we had the windows rolled down for quite a bit, and we drove through a village that was pretty dusty, or an area that was pretty dusty. So we rolled the windows up, and yeah. And as Rodney said, we were both looking out the side windows, and the car came to a screeching halt. And I think we both snapped our heads around in time to see us hit this elderly man. And he flew up on the hood of the car and then immediately flew backwards onto the street, and we couldn't see him. I think, oh my God, just flew out of my mouth. And Fitzam, our guide, jumped out of the front seat, and I instinctively jumped out of the back seat, and Fitzam turned around and screamed at me, "Get in the car now." And when I did that, the driver immediately locked the doors, and within about 30 seconds.
Yeah, if that long.
Yeah.
It was instant.
Hundreds of these South Sudanese people came running from over from the both sides of the street. We basically had a mob of about 6 feet of people all the way around our car. And
it's just like you see in the movies. And, you know, the scenes where there's, you know, the reporter or whoever, you know, in these, where it's the angry mob where they're just, you can't see beyond because there's so many people. There were at least 200 men just surrounded, banging on the windows, and you're just trying not to make,
you know,
trying not to make eye contact. And every once in a while you'd catch an eye, and it was the most
unnerving.
Yeah, it was the scariest thing. But you know, the thing that was so weird too is, as scary as it was, it was so surreal at the same time, where, you know, half my brain's going, oh my God, I'm going to die, and the other half's going, wow, this is crazy. What's going on here?
All right, what a way to go.
Huh? Yeah. Right. I think
we're going to have some stories if we get home.
Yeah. I think we both really honestly felt like we were going to get pulled out of this car and pummeled. And
well, we asked Fitzam that when we finally got away from there, and he said, you know, were they going to kill us? And he said, well, about half of them wanted to, and the other half were, you know, because we were this only guy's hope to get him to a hospital, because fortunately we didn't kill him.
Yeah.
So where was he? I mean, did you him to the hospital?
He was on the street in front of the car. And
but I mean, where'd you put him in the SUV? And
he just, they pulled him in the front seat.
Front seat between Fitzam and the driver. And when they unlocked the doors, they picked the old man up. There's no waiting for an ambulance, waiting to collar him to see if there was a spinal injury. They picked him up, put him in the car, and said, we got to take him to a local clinic in the village.
And yeah, the clinic was, again, this is the kind of thing, the story, I wish we had photos, but we don't, because this was, you know.
So you didn't pull your camera out and just start taking pictures, right?
I wanted to. But,
I bet you did. But
Fitzam was, you know, no, you know, mm-hmm. do not pull your camera out. Mm. But
so was the clinic in the same village where you were sitting?
Yeah, there was, we drove, and like I said, when you say clinic, you turn off the main road, and you go onto this just crappy, it's not even a road, and we pull in, it looked like somebody's
house,
home with a little pavilion outside, and they drag the guy in there, and again Rick and I are just sitting in the truck by ourselves going, what are we gonna do? And I guess, but we were there what, 15-20 minutes?
Yeah.
And they bring him back, and like, well, they can't help him. And so then what did we drive, an hour?
Yeah,
to get
said,
to,
they said, when you take him to a real hospital,
and yeah, a real hospital. this was a hospital. I mean, it did resemble one, but you get in there and
it looked more like a horse stable than a hospital.
the hallways were just covered in mud. There were literally chickens running through, and all the gear, you know, the gurneys and the wheelchairs all looked like they were donated from the 50s, if that.
Yeah,
and this guy, he's laying on the gurney in the hallway, and then by then, you know, Rick and I had been sitting there for a little bit, you know, not just, we didn't, where did Fitzham go at the time?
The old man, there was no outwardly blood. He wasn't bleeding out, but he was screaming and moaning the entire time. So he obviously had internal injuries. And we were there, the door to this hospital was an iron door. The bottom half was solid, but the top half just had rebar for bars, like a horse stable stall door would have. And Fitzham was checking on the man that was the driver hit. And about 30 minutes later, he comes to us and said, the police are here. They found out where we were bringing the old man to, and they followed us. And the police want me and the driver and the cook and the car to follow him to the police station. He goes, I don't know when I'll be back, but just stay here and wait on me. I will be back for you.
He literally left Rick and I at this hospital in the middle of nowhere. Nope. And if he hadn't come back, I don't know what we would have done.
We wouldn't be sitting here, that's for sure.
Nobody knew where we were.
No one spoke English. There was no cell service. There was no Wi-Fi. We, about 3.5 hours into it, you know, Rodney and I were talking. It was like, you know, he might not come back. They could have easily arrested him and impounded the car. That's what they would have done in the U.S. He might not be able to continue this tour. So we were kind of coming up with plans B, C, and D.
And we did at least get our luggage out. So we had all of our gear and, you know, clothes. But yeah, we had all this gear and we're stuck.
So how long
We didn't even know where we were. At least I didn't.
How long did you have to wait before?
We were there about 4 hours before Fitzham came back. And we discussed trying to get a cab to drive us 13 hours back to the capital city of Addis Ababa and get the hell out of Dodge. And finally he came back and he said, we've got to take the old man back to a real hospital in Jimma, the airport we flew into, which was, what, about an hour and a half away.
Yeah, so we're going back to where we started.
And he goes, we're gonna stay the night in Jimma. And I've got one of my other drivers and my other cars driving all night to pick us up at 4 a.m. And I'm going to do my best to make up time and see the tribes that you know, I told you that I would take you to see.
So, yeah, to get us back to the town, like the where the airport was and where the hospital was that they wanted to take him to, Rick and I were riding shotgun in the ambulance with the old man in the back, with his whole family. How many people were in the back?
I think about eight.
Eight people in the back of this thing. And the guy driving the ambulance, and it's the old classic siren. It's that, wah, 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 wah. And this guy, he's driving just like our driver was. Now we're in the front seat having to witness all this, white knuckling with an ambulance, zooming in and out of donkeys and chickens and goats, and this guy's in the back moaning, and our driver, he's just in shorts and a t-shirt, and he had some bag of seeds or something, and he's got the window down, he's chewing on them, spitting out the window, just driving, hand on the wheel, like no, there's no big deal, and we're just we got to get out of here.
Yeah,
and they drop him off at the hospital, and then the ambulance drives us over to the hotel, and they tell us, you know, hang out, and your guide will be back.
And it was real funny when Fitzham came back to the hotel where we were waiting for like 4 hours, and he said we had to take him back to Jimma, and I said, well, how do we get him there if they've kept your car? Because he said that they kept the cook and the driver and the car. And they released me because I came up with a financial settlement for the man's family. And Rodney and I go, well, how are we going to get back if they kept your car? And he goes, we're going to go buy an ambulance. And we never saw an ambulance. And as Rodney said, the ambulance was this tiny little old Toyota pickup truck with a little camper shell on the back. And they had built this hardwood table on the bed of the truck. And they had two bench seats on each side of it. So there was four people on each side and the old man laying on this hardwood table without even a mattress. And Rodney and I were crammed in the front seat. And even with the ambulance, the siren going, that these people were still in the middle of the street and we were dodging people and nearly hit another one and an animal. It was comical on one side, but pretty unnerving on the other.
Yeah, it's funny now that we're home and can tell the story. Yeah. But yeah, we got back to the hotel, and it was kind of how Rick and I first met. You know, over many bottles of wine. You know, we're sitting there just drinking, going,
"What do you want to do?
What are we going to do?" And we were both just going, "Oh my God, let's just go home." But then, you know, the other side of the brain's going,
"We're here.
But we're here, and think of the stories we're going to have. Nobody else sees this." And thank God we decided to stay. And so, yeah, our guide finally showed up, and he let us know that we had a car coming, and we would be leaving at 4 a.m. And so we got up at 4, and we didn't drive straight through. We ended up actually doing the same original.
Yeah, we stopped. We were originally going to stop halfway through and spend the night in a hotel. And the driver picked us up at 4 a.m. I think you had your bag. I had my backpack with my camera gear in it. But I think Fitzen went back and got my bag, because when we were at the hotel, I didn't even have a toothbrush. I brushed my teeth with my finger on a bar of soap that morning. And they picked us up at 4 a.m. and we started back the same direction we were going in that previous day. And it was pitch dark, and we were, what, about 30 minutes into the trip and nearly hit a hippo that was in the middle of the highway.
Let's save that story. Okay. Because, gentlemen, believe it or not, this has been a wonderful introduction to your trip. And I have already labeled this episode "The Incident." And I think it has whet the appetite for our listeners. But what I think we're going to do is bring this part one to a close, because when we first started talking about this, we said we have more than enough to do a couple of episodes on this. So before we kind of close this out, did anybody ever hear how the old man?
We were told he lived. Our guy kept calling in and checking, and they told us that he lived, thankfully. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You didn't have a triumphant return back to the village to deliver him or anything
no.
like that?
No. Yeah, we thought it was in our best interest to get out as soon as we could. But Fitzen did keep in touch, and apparently he was... he did have, I forget what it was that, what the injuries were, but yeah, he was expected to recover and everybody was all good.
Well, that's clearly an exciting story and very fun to hear the two of you tell it. But from the safety of beautiful bucolic Wimberley, Texas, as we're sitting here today, as you think back and reflect on it, in addition to just the sheer adrenaline rush that was going on, can you recall any maybe observations or thoughts that you had about those first probably 8 hours in Ethiopia that set the tone for that trip, or anything that you think about the incident now that sticks with you in a deep, hard way, if you will? If you had time to catch your breath and come down and realize that you were still alive, thank you, and the trip was going to continue. What are some reflections, I guess, is the word I would use on that, Rick?
Everything was interesting in these villages. You know, I've done a lot of third world. I love doing
I'm not talking world. About Ethiopia in general. I'm just talking about that first eight-hour introduction that you had. What else kind of resonates with you? Or maybe it is just the blood-pumping adrenaline of the experience, but you all were absorbing a lot, and I would imagine that takes time to process.
It did, and when we got back to the hotel and sat down over a couple of bottles of wine, we couldn't believe what just happened. I mean, I'm used to travel mishaps, but I've never had anything like this happen where we.
Actually, mishap is a lovely little word. All went through.
Right. Where we actually hurt a human being, and it obviously wasn't our fault, but it still happened, and it was just so unnerving. And I think we were operating on pure adrenaline.
Did it color in any way your expectations about what the rest of your trip would be like, or apprehensions, or excitement, or?
I think at one point Rodney goes, "I don't know if I can do 9 days a night white knuckle driving," and and it did get better.
The trip itself, you know, the you know, the villages, like I said, we'll just get into that on the next episode, but there were some hair-raising moments, but compared to the driving, they were nothing. It was, yeah, that driving just, it was excruciating. It was mm-hmm. awful. But yeah, we were in villages with, you know, these tribes that half of them were running around with AK-47s and firing them off over our heads. And after the drive, you just go,
didn't seem so bad.
No.
Well, there's always a sunny side, right? I mean, that's a perfect example. So when we come back in our next episode, really want to hear more in depth about the villages and any differences that you experienced with the villages. Did you do any animal photography in Ethiopia, or was it more central and focused in the?
Yeah, this was all
people,
all people, okay. All the tribes. Yeah, okay. There's not a lot of wildlife left over yeah. there.
We saw huge baboons. We saw some hyenas, and
we saw hyenas.
Yeah.
Was I sleeping on that?
I think we saw them a couple of times. But yeah, they had told us that when the people, these tribal people, got their guns, and I'm not sure where they got them from, that they pretty much had killed off all the wildlife, which is very unfortunate.
Mm. Did they say what had been there before? Was there?
I think it's a lot of the same stuff that you see in Kenya.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Was it borders Kenya?
Oh, that's really... really telling and unfortunate. So because it's really just kind of like, okay, guys, back in your corral now. Let's take a little break, and then we're going to let you loose on a whole other thing. So I bet our listeners have enjoyed that ride a lot more than you did at the time. So we are literally...
looking back, we enjoyed it, but not at the time.
So we are literally off and running, and I want to thank all of you listeners for being here with us today for this episode of Passport Please. We want to thank our special guest, Mr. Rick Minchu, who I'm happy to say we're going to be hearing more from in our next episode. Want to thank our wonderful producer, Brock Glenn Thomas, who makes us sound better than we deserve to be. We want to thank Rupert Neve Design for our studio gear, which we are enjoying immensely. We want to also help you to notice that our intro music and our outgoing music is by Donovan Frankenreiter. So pay attention to that. You can find the music on his CD, Start Living. And remember that great adventures of the mind, body, and spirit happen when you hear the words, Passport, Please. So until next time.